So there were a lot of bombs being thrown in various directions in this paper. Maybe you didn't catch all of them. If you have a chance to read over it carefully, it's very provocative. There are a lot of points where I have to say I wanted to sort of stop the bus and get off. I actually found that the discussion of same-sex relations actually really, for me, like it sort of, contrary to your purpose, it really sort of made me, it reminded me of why I thought neutrality was a good idea to start with. So let me just say and remind the audience of what Dick said. He said the claim that same-sex sex is good strikes me as evidently true and a suitable basis for public policy in a diverse democracy. He went on to then to argue that neutrality is not adequate because it doesn't guarantee fairness. And so, quote, bringing it about that all individuals have adequate opportunities for sexual and romantic fulfillment may require not merely laws protecting people's freedom and privacy, but also non-neutral state policies whereby the state declares itself to be for the controversial good in this area. So that was the part where I began to, well, like I said, reminded me of why I like neutrality, because that struck me as so problematic on multiple levels. And so the first problem, it seemed to me, is that it is worth keeping in mind that, for example, a majority of Americans believe that homosexuality is sinful. So I think 53% last time I looked it up, right? So the view that it's not sinful is a minority view, and my mind boggles trying to imagine the political mechanism through which a minority can impose its correct, yet nevertheless minority view of the nature of the good through non-neutral state policies. And it seems to me that what is to prevent the majority from using that same mechanism to impose its incorrect view? And might the minority not prefer, just as a hedge against that possibility, state neutrality as a way of simply avoiding losing the contest for whatever this mechanism is going to be, which is going to allow minorities to impose their particular conceptions of the good upon using the mechanism of the state? So that was the first point. The second, I thought that in the first half of the paper, you strongly identified the neutrality debate with the good versus the right, which is how Rawls characterized it in his early work. And I think that led you to, in your mind often, to sort of think about neutrality in terms of deontology and perfectionism in terms of consequentialism, various forms of utilitarianism as examples of perfectionism. But I think that's often misleading because it's really easy, as you yourself mentioned, to tweak utilitarianism in such a way as to make it neutral. So I think it'd be more helpful to think of perfectionism in terms of what I like to call red meat perfectionism, or people who really have like a strong, affirmative, and highly particular conception of the good. So I often think of Thomism as my example. It's not even that red meat. I know lots of very nice Thomists, right? But again, it has to do with the view that same-sex relations are sinful is a pretty immediate consequence of what is. It's not a view that I share, but it's a view that I understand how people paint themselves into a corner on this, and I understand how very religious people have a real problem when it comes to deciding that they're going to publicly endorse homosexuality is okay. I mean, it is important to remember that the status of homosexuality is generating possibly the most significant schism in the Anglican Church right now since the Reformation. I mean, this is a huge problem for churches to come around to this idea that there's nothing wrong with homosexuality. And it has to do with the way this whole comprehensive view works, right? Thomism is one instance of it. But the idea is that natural law is dictated by goods that are embedded in nature. Those goods reflect divine purposes, right? If you look at anything in nature, you ask, what good does it serve? And so for thousands of years, people have looked at our reproductive organs and sexual activities, and they've said, what is the good that this serves? And the answer, procreation, right, was the obvious answer to that question for thousands of years. And so you then got a catalog of sexual vices. And that traditional catalog of vices, which was stable for, again, over 1,000 years in the Christian tradition, was every single form of non-procreative sexual activity was regarded as a vice. And so, and then you had a whole view of divine revelation and the ways in which the Bible reinforces this and so on and so forth, the importance of revelation and tradition within that Christian worldview and so on. So that's like a huge package view. It's very difficult to then come along to someone who subscribes to this view and say, we wanted you to take one or two things out of that list. Based on nothing within that worldview that would lead to a kind of principled revision of it. So I guess I feel for people who are really pinched by this. Like, I really understand how a certain kind of religious view makes it incredibly difficult to acknowledge the non-sinfulness of homosexuality. Now, it's facile to say, oh, well, that's a good reason to not have that religious view. Like, people are deeply committed to these sorts of views, right? And it's not like, you know, we have all kinds of other views that are just self-evidently more attractive when it comes to cosmologies. So that's the 53%, right? But now take the 47% who think it's perhaps either neutral or some kind of a good. The way Dick's argument worked, I mean, you said they think it's a good, but it's entirely possible for amongst those 47% who don't think it's evil, those who think it's some kind of a good, it's quite easy for people to think that same-sex relations are good, but less good than other types of sexual relations. I mean, many people think, sexual relations lead to all kinds of things that we regard as good. So, although not directly producing emotional intimacy, they're capable of leading to emotional intimacy. And many people think that sex without the possibility of intimacy is less good than sex with the possibility of intimacy. Similarly, heterosexual sex is capable of leading to children. Many people think that sex that is not capable of so leading is less good. They don't think there's anything wrong with it, they just think it's less good. But the way the argument is structured suggested that the state needs to actively promote policies that would make people sort of gender blind when it came to choice of sexual partner, the way they are race blind, ideally they would be race blind with respect to choice of sexual partner. And that would only follow if the two were regarded as equally good. Well, maybe that's not what you meant, but you were using a race gender analogy. So,
there's such a thing as sexual orientation.
It wasn't entirely clear in your discussion exactly how you saw it working, but all I want to suggest is that the stuff is reasonably controversial on a lot of different dimensions. The people who think it's wrong have reasons that I don't share, but I can see. The people who think it's less good have reasons that I also don't share, but I can see, right? And there's reasonably controversial means that you can really see how people of good faith and, well, whatever, disagree on it, right? It's reasonable disagreement. In which case, it seems to me that neutrality recommends itself. Like, as soon as you broach the discussion, it just seems to me it says, let's just stay out of this, right? Like, let's just let people work this out for themselves. The second thing is, in the roles discussion, I think I wanted to bring this up independently, is that whenever we talk about neutrality, one thing that never gets brought up that I think should be central to it is that it seems to me that Pareto efficiency is the gold standard for a neutral principle of justice, and that's sometimes the elephant in the room. The philosophical discussion doesn't identify that often enough, right? I mean, Pareto efficiency is what has allowed economists for the last century to go about doing essentially normative analysis while claiming to be doing science, right? And why? It's because, well, Pareto efficiency is totally non-controversial, and therefore we can do welfare economics. Pareto efficiency, I think, is a nice example, and I think a lot of what political philosophers have been trying to do is to get principles that would be as neutral as Pareto efficiency. That is not an example of a rock-bottom commitment. Pareto efficiency is very much one of the sort of freestanding commitments, and I don't know if many people have this experience, but my experience when I first encountered the Pareto efficiency principle was that I had an extremely facile, moralizing dismissal of it. That it struck me as being wrong, not particularly binding, not particularly attractive or interesting. Why? Because it didn't, jive with some of these sort of more strict moral commitments that I had, right? And I find that when teaching it to students and so forth, undergrads all have very, very glib moralizing rejections of the principle. But I've also found, though, that it's grown on me over the years, right? And one of the reasons that it's grown on me over the years is precisely its robustness, right? The fact that it really can be defended from a lot of different perspectives. And it's really not difficult to take people's views, say an environmentalist, and re-describe things in such a way that suddenly they find themselves endorsing Pareto efficiency, right? So it's something that's capable. So it's not a rock-bottom commitment. It's a very superficial principle. But it's one which is able to find grounding in a wide range of different comprehensive doctrines. And it's enormously robust, right? So that's what I think we should be thinking of when we're sort of picturing what we're after for principles that are going to be neutral. And because of that, though, I found the pollution example with arguing that they, you know, that there's no asymmetry between trumping someone's moral judgment versus trumping someone's empirical judgment. The example didn't work for me because in the case of someone who's polluting, the relevant principle that you'll be using to stop them from polluting is an efficiency principle. It struck me that, I mean, that's just the way you read it, right? They're generating an externality, they want a free ride. It doesn't matter what their moral theory is, you impose a principle upon them. But that principle is so neutral that I of course treat that as being similar to trumping their empirical judgments. So for the example to work better for me, it would have to be a case where you were using some kind of deep ecology judgment or something like that to trump that person's desire to. So it wouldn't be polluting, but say, you know what I mean? Like where the moral principle in question was self-evidently controversial. Whereas it seems to me with the pollution case, the moral principle is so neutral that it's not really controversial. So for example, like where I live, it's almost impossible to cut down a tree anymore. And there is something kind of controversial about that in the sense that, you know, I have some neighbors who come from parts of the world where clearly cutting down trees is a good thing to do, right? And that the impulse is to cut down all trees as soon as you declare something, you know, this is my home, I will now cut down the trees. It's sort of the natural. And, you know, the neighborhood is, but town council is dominated by old hippies who find trees intrinsically good. And as a result, it's illegal to cut down trees. And immigrants get charged because they don't know they're not allowed to cut down trees, and they cut them down, and then they get fined, and so on. That would be a case where I might see more of a difference, where I'm not totally, I mean, of course, the hippies make externality arguments for trees and stuff like that, but really, you know, it's because they love trees that they're making it illegal to cut down trees. So if it were a deep ecology argument or something like that on a moral case, then the asymmetry for me would be perhaps easier to see. Then finally, the question you ask is basically, why should a public reasonable doctrine ever be subordinated to a semi-rational private doctrine as an aspect of Rawls' system that doesn't seem to make sense? You know, it just seems logical that if you have this publicly reasonable doctrine, which is developed on the basis of good reasons, and you've got these sort of crazy private beliefs on the side, that the latter should be just immediately be subordinate to the former. What I want to say about that discussion, though, is that you use this term of moral principles that cannot reasonably be rejected, that is not in Rawls's work, and that presupposes a kind of foundational notion of reasonable rejectability that one can find in Scanlon, but one certainly doesn't find in Rawls. Reasonable rejectability for Rawls just is whether or not it can attract an overlapping consensus, that is, whether people's private comprehensive doctrines can endorse it. And so, for Rawls, something which is publicly, which is not reasonably rejectable through public use of reason, is not going to subsequently be trumped by some private comprehensive doctrine, because the notion of reasonable rejectability can't be defined outside the context of the private comprehensive doctrines that are there. The other thing I want to say is just, again, is that, that having been said, Rawls also doesn't say that private comprehensive doctrines simply trump public ones. He does think it goes both ways. And so you may recall he says the values of the political are very great values indeed. And there may be many circumstances in which there's an attractive public conception of justice that just conflicts with a private comprehensive doctrine. And it may be the case that the former has to override the latter simply because of all of the virtues of political cooperation that flow from having everyone accept a certain public conception of justice. So he, at one point, he says, the values that conflict with the political conception of justice and its sustaining virtues may be normally outweighed because they come into conflict with the very conditions that make for fair social cooperation possible on a footing of mutual respect. Right? So he has a sort of complicated view, naturally, of the relationship between the two. But it's not the case that one person standing up saying, my crazy religious view prohibits this, is enough to defeat the publicness of a particular conception of justice. Okay, Alan's paper. So I was going to say, I noticed Alan was the second person today to use what I've heard someone call the Scanlon heuristic, which is growing in popularity, which is that if Justice Scanlon believes that P, then not P is the heuristic. I've never said his name out loud, so as you can tell, I don't use the heuristic. But anyhow, I guess I want to resist the Scalia heuristic. Here was just the one difficulty that I saw. And I read a version of it that was different from what he presented, but that there were substantial overlap. That is, he starts with two principles, the non-discrimination and the neutral intentions principle, which is the core of the formal view. And he says that this is inadequate because it's not going to generate the kinds of accommodations that seem reasonable. And therefore, in the version I read, he sort of adds a third principle called the principle of priority. Here it was, you switch to the priority view, which seemed fine to me, except that when you went on to apply the priority view, you then made reference to and employed a principle of fairness, which then did some fairly substantial work in making the application of the priority view reasonable. And it seemed to me, though, that when the question was asked, is the formal view able to generate the right kinds of accommodations, that principle of fairness wasn't available or wasn't at the disposition of the person who was trying to defend a formal view. But it seemed to me, looking at it, that the combination of the formal view plus the principle of fairness that you were employing was sufficient to generate the kinds of accommodations that you were looking for without necessarily having to introduce a priority principle. And part of what I thought was that you were sort of too quick to buy Brian Berry's arguments. Namely, you considered the fairness objections against accommodations, but didn't look at the fairness arguments for accommodations. And there are some well-known, Will Kimmelker makes them, and lots of people have made these kind of fairness arguments for accommodation. And it seemed to me, therefore, that the non-discrimination neutral intention plus fairness is enough to motivate it in a lot of cases. So the thing, I was always mystified by like culture and equality, because if you look through it, Berry's arguments against rule and exemption approaches, he takes his examples, like say the speed limit, and he says, well, either there's a case to be made for having the rule, in which case applies to everyone, or there isn't, in which case everyone should be able to do what they want. But if you look at something like a speed limit, speed limits are not sort of picked out a priori, right? They involve this incredibly complex balancing of the interests of different parties in these interactions. And they're incredibly, at the municipal level, people have huge fights over these things, right? So, if you go down a residential street, there's going to be a speed limit of, say, 30 kilometers an hour. That is a balancing of the interests of the residents who probably wanted it at 10 or 20 kilometers an hour. And the people who sometimes drive through it on the way to work who'd like to have it at 50 or 60 and so forth. So the way speed limits work, and so then certain streets designated as thoroughfares and the speed limit goes up to 50, and then some things get highways with level intersections, the speed limit becomes 80 and so forth, right? Every single one of those speed limits involves a complicated balancing of interests using a highly schematic representation of what the relevant interests at play are, right? So residents and people on bikes, pedestrians, children have kind of stereotypical interests that are taken into account. And then commuters, people driving, and so on, have different interests. And you balance them. But even with the rules that we have, we recognize that there are certain types of trips, for example, in vehicles, that don't meet the stereotype of the typical interests of a person driving a car. And so rather than changing the kind of balance, we permit exemptions. So the speed limit, for example, has some obvious built-in exemptions, like emergency vehicles, right? Or traffic lights have exemptions as well, which is the police are allowed to drive through them, right? And ambulances are allowed to exceed the speed limit. And supposedly, men driving their pregnant wives to the hospital are allowed to exceed the speed limit and so forth, right? So, but the one for emergency vehicles is codified in part of the law. So the example he gives of a uniform rule itself, in fact, contains an exemption. So, and why is that? Well, there are pretty basic considerations of fairness and balancing of interests that lead to that. So this idea that we just disregard impact is simply not true when it comes to the formulations of the very laws that Berry himself gives as an example. So he says the speed limit has disparate impact, but we don't care because some people like to drive fast and we disregard their interests. Who cares, right? But it's not true. It would have disparate impact if, for example, when you were having a heart attack and being rushed to the hospital, if you weren't allowed to exceed the speed limit, that would have disparate impact. And we do pay attention to that by building in an exemption. So when a group comes along and says, aha, you formulated this rule because of this highly schematic representation of what the typical interests of community members are, but you did not realize that we have an interest that that is different substantially from that of the other members of the community, and this impacts upon us in a completely different way. Then exactly the same mechanism of balancing an equal sharing of burdens that led to the original rule can easily generate an exemption to that rule. So I thought the fairness argument could be you were sort of worried about the fairness argument eliminating accommodations. I think you also have to worry about the fairness argument simply handling all the accommodations that are necessary, and therefore rendering a particular priority principle unnecessary. And then the last thing is just kind of an offhand comment, which is just that when you formulate claims of conscience, I know that you extend it to include non-religious ones, and so, you know, ethical, metaphysical, philosophical, and so forth, right? But I have to say that every time someone says that, to me, it lacks credibility. Like, I just have difficulty, on a purely normative level, I can see it, but in terms of the way this kind of stuff typically gets implemented, it always winds up, you know, with a few very, very slight exceptions, being religious. And so the idea that, you know, my wife is Chinese and an atheist, and complains about the fact that she has to cover people's call on Jewish holidays, on Christmas, on Diwali, and so forth, but that doesn't get Chinese New Year's off. Why? Because even though it's culturally important, it's a secular holiday, and so it sort of doesn't count. And then also sort of atheists in general don't get special holidays and time off work, sort of thing. I mean, just the way the dynamics of these things work, it's just not the case that these accommodations get made for non-religious groups. So I do think there's an issue there that just sort of extending the list doesn't give me enough comfort. You know, whenever you're talking about privileging claims of conscience specifically, that's why my preference is for the fairness arguments, because they don't single out conscience. But last, wrapping up. George's paper, I have to say, I didn't substantially disagree with very much in it, which makes for boring commentary at conferences. So I thought, to make it more exciting, and seeing as though we're at McGill, I thought I would pretend that I'm Charles Taylor. And this is what I would say if I were Charles Taylor. Not what Charles Taylor would say, this is what I would say if I were Charles Taylor. I would say the following, that there is something very perverse about this project, nothing wrong specifically, but perverse, as a development of Berlin's work. What I take to be Berlin's most important contribution to our understanding of liberalism is his sort of very forthright recognition that the liberal tradition, like any other complex tradition of political thought, involves a constellation of values that are themselves in tension with one another. There's no coherent little package of principles that constitutes liberalism. Liberalism is not just a constellation, it's the sort of force field of tension that exists within these simultaneously incompatible commitments that have played themselves out over 200-300 years of Western history. It's the fact that liberals are committed to liberty and equality and democracy, and you can't have all of those things at once, is what makes liberalism this dynamic political tradition. So the same way that modernity needs to be understood, not identified with, for example, the Enlightenment, modernity is part of that package that includes the counter-Enlightenment, right? It includes things that we want that we can't all have at once. Liberalism also includes a package of things that all attract us, but that we can't have simultaneously. So that liberalism shouldn't be identified with any particular value, particular set of principles, but rather a constellation of values that are in tension with one another. Unfortunately, the liberals have this sort of wrong self-understanding, that is that they try to present themselves always as if they were above the fray, as though everybody else has this problem that they have to fight for their particular values and they have to reconcile these problems. But the sort of we're not doing that because we've got this sort of meta position which allows us to, you know, develop principles that are completely independent of particular values. And that, as it were, kind of falsifies the real nature of liberalism. First, that liberalism has always been a fighting creed, right? That it's always been on the ground, involved in pitched confrontation with other systems of value. And secondly, the historical aspect of liberalism, right? That is, that there is nothing that kind of defines liberalism. It's a political tradition. The reason it's a tradition is because it's a force field of tension, which can only be sort of played out and exemplified within a community of political societies that we recognize to be sort of broadly liberal, right? Like a family of practices. So I would say that what you're developing here is not really liberalism, first order liberalism, which is historically embedded. What you're developing is kind of meta-liberalism, which is, again, an attempt to kind of be above the fray. And in that respect, you're sort of reshuffling the same deck of cards that liberals have been shuffling for a very long time. Berlin's big insight was to call the bluff on that, right? Was to argue that, look, liberalism is a set of values, concrete, historically embedded values, and the way liberals should defend liberalism is by trying to articulate more perspicuously exactly the nature of those values. And the game of trying to do meta-liberalism, or develop these higher order principles, in many ways just renders liberals inarticulate when it comes to actually presenting the force of the actual values that they're committed to. Right. But that's not what